right, so we got you back now, and you're a full-fledged member of the Orlando Police Department, right?
That's correct.
And you show up for your first shift, and of course, they got you working Monday through Friday days, right?
Initially, that was during the academy. Once I graduated, I was placed, which they kind of asked you where you want to go. I knew it wasn't going to be day shift because you're more seasoned, more senior officers are usually on day shift, and it's understandable. Mm-hmm. So it was either evening shift or midnight shift. And I said, you know what? I want to go to midnights. Sounds good to me. And it sort of, you know, worked in my household because by the time Nancy was going to work, she was a teacher mm-hmm. at the time. I was coming home from work. So then I would go to sleep and I'd sleep all day. And she would wake me up when she would get back from work, which was around 3 o'clock. And then we could go grocery shopping, cook dinner, eat, watch TV or whatnot. And then by the time she was going to sleep or getting ready to go to bed, I was getting ready to go to work. Mm-hmm. She would go to bed by 10:45, I was back at the station because we had lineup. And then my shift started. It was 11 at night till 7 in the morning. And
What area of town were you assigned to the first time?
Initially, I was assigned to the northeast part of the city. That would be an area. You have a lot of your shopping malls. The executive airport is in that mm-hmm. area.
Mm-hmm. Colonial Drive?
Colonial Drive. In essence, it was between I-4 and Cimarron Boulevard mm-hmm. and between Colonial Drive and the 408, which is the East-West Expressway.
Yeah.
And at the time, downtown itself, closer to the Lake Eola side, it was going through mm-hmm. a lot of – they were revitalizing it, new construction. So it was fairly calm. You get a lot of your, we have a pretty high transient population, you know, people that are in and out of the Coalition for the Homeless. And they would usually migrate into that area of town because it was safer. So you just get a little bit of your petty crimes, like somebody stole my kid's scooter or the bicycle or that kind of thing. And then towards the backside of my district or zone, I would have like the businesses, a lot of the Fashion mm-hmm. Square Mall and some of the other restaurants and strip malls. So it was fairly quiet. I mean, and I worked there for about a year and then, I started to get a little restless.
I'll bet.
And then I wanted something else to do and, ended up going into the west side of the city. And that would be from literally I-4 going down towards the theme parks like Kirkman Road, mm-hmm. Universal Studios. And then, that would be your west-east margins, and then we would have from Colonial Drive all the way down to, like, International Drive, down in the tourist sector. That's the west side. Within the west side, I went to work specifically in it's one of the poor areas of our city. Mm-hmm. A lot of different kind of crimes there. On the east side, the population was predominantly white and Hispanic. They put me there because I speak Spanish. But then on the west side, it's predominantly African-American. And then, of course, you got the tourist. And then you got small sections of your more affluent communities, but really on the west side, but what's called Metro West. But my district, it was a very active district. And it was for all the action. A lot of good people live there. A lot of good, hardworking people live there. Law-abiding citizens, God-fearing. But you also got a pretty large segment that it's the total opposite. Actually, they do work. It's not in the probably in the most appropriate kind of entrepreneurship that you want to be involved mm-hmm. in. Mainly, it was the narcotics trade. It's just the drugs and violent crimes. Yeah.
Were you seeing gang activity over there?
Not so much on the west side. There was quite a bit on the east side.
Really?
When I was there. There was quite a bit specifically towards the southeast, which would be predominantly from the 408, the East-West Expressway, down mm-hmm. towards the airport mm-hmm. and between Cimarron Boulevard down towards I-4 once again. And at the time, a lot of it was fueled Hispanic gangs, Latin Kings. They were mm-hmm. big at the time there, and just all your little upstarts. We were not seeing a lot of what we see now and hear a lot about MS-13, that kind of thing. That wasn't people were still stuck on the Latin Kings and maybe a little bit on the west side of the Crips and Bloods kind of thing, like the founding fathers of it all, if you want to say, but not so much on the west side. I didn't see a lot of that. What we did see, it was a lot of just the violent crimes. I mean, it was the robberies, the home invasions, the carjackings, the smash and grabs, properties against crime, especially during closer to the tourist areas, because you have all the outlet mm-hmm. shops and you would get your thefts at the hotels that were on the drive, that kind of thing. But mainly where I was, a lot of it was just drugs. It's just drugs and home invasions. And I found those to be usually interesting, because I don't think I ever worked a home invasion where maybe there was, and I just don't recall, that the victim of the home invasion, that you would ask them, do you know these people that home invaded you? Nobody ever knew anybody. And I was like, that happens. Yeah, because that happens all the time. You're sitting at home watching TV, eating your mm-hmm. dinner, and somebody just kicks the door in and wants to rob you for no reason at all. So there is usually a reason why that happened. And that always traced back to which was your area of expertise. It was the narcotics trade. So,
yep. So how long did you stay over in that district?
I stayed there until I retired. That's why what I did. I mean, I was on the road. I had put in to go to the bike unit, to the bicycle unit, to neighborhood police teams. And I was waiting transfer when my incident happened. Mm-hmm. So I never made it there. So I spent I spent my whole career on the road working the midnight shift. And it's, tell my kids, there's been times when we'll go down to see an Orlando Magic basketball game or something. Mm-hmm. And when we're leaving the arena, I'm cutting through. I'm very familiar with that area of Central and the West Side. So I'm just cutting through to avoid all the traffic. But my kids, we live in suburbia. I mean, white picket fence kind of thing, you know, to that life. And we were driving by, and they, like my son, one time I drove by the Coalition for the homeless. And at that time, the Coalition closes at night, but you have everybody that's didn't make it in. They're outside. It looks like Skid Row over in LA, miniature version. But you see all these people, and my son's just looking out the window like he's never seen anything like that. And I tried to explain to him. It's like, I mean, and this is not to, I don't think I'm better than anybody else, okay? And a human life is a human life. I mean, sometimes circumstances dictate where we are in life, but many times it's the choices that we make. We can choose make our choices. We just can't choose our consequences. You see these people, and it's like almost like the Walking Dead. It's like zombies. You know, they're just coming out, you know, and it's mm-hmm. like this underbelly that you really, when you go to work on your regular 8-to-5 job, Saturdays and Sundays, you're running errands with your family and going to church and Little League. I mean, why not? You don't see this, but nighttime falls and it's 11 o'clock at night, midnight. They come out of somewhere. I wish I knew where they go, because I never saw them during the day. So it was a different crowd altogether. It's just a different breed that comes out at that time.
So on February 3rd, 2000, you're on the midnight shift?
I'm on the midnight shift.
And let me just, if you would, just walk us through the events of that night.
Sure. I was working. It was about maybe like 1:15, 1:20 in the morning. I was driving down close to John Young Parkway, which is one of our main thoroughfares, right next to First Baptist Church of Orlando, real big church that we have here. And I see this car is driving opposite to where I'm going, and they have a broken windshield. And they have, well, that's what I see, a broken windshield. So I make a U-turn and get behind the car. It was a blue Chevy Cavalier, four-door. And I noticed that they don't have like a regular tag. They have a temp tag, and it's not lit at all neither. So there's no light to it. I just went ahead and initiated a traffic stop on that vehicle. And we ended up stopping just probably a couple blocks shy of I-4, but on John Young, going southbound, and actually a couple blocks further from, like one or two blocks further from I-4 on John Young is the county jail. So I was probably about a good 5 blocks from the county jail. The sheriff's office headquarters at the time was right there also for Orange County. And we're in front of the church during the midnight hour. Stopped the vehicle. And it's crazy. Through the years, I've replayed this scenario so many times in my mind. things that happened and how it played out. But I did so many things that I normally, in many cases, didn't do previously. We're taught at OPD, when we stop a vehicle and we're making contact with that driver, we would walk up, like most people see in the movies or TV shows, mm-hmm. or on the side of the road, you walk up to the driver's side window. That day, and if there wasn't really an overabundant amount of traffic. That was on a Wednesday night going on a Thursday morning. There wasn't a lot of traffic on John Young. But I decided when I got out of my car, I proceeded to walk behind my vehicle. And I just stood by the trunk of my car, just watching. And nothing really stuck out as, yeah, there's something amiss. What most people would consider, that you hear the term so often, a routine traffic stop. Right. We know that that's not true, but that's what most people would categorize it. I went ahead and I walked up to the car. I was on the right side on the embankment on the grass. And I stopped short of the right rear passenger window. That's where I stopped. And it's funny because I'm standing there with my flashlight and I'm just flashing it all in the car, just looking around. And I don't see anything that sticks out. And everybody's looking to the driver's side. Everybody's looking up to the driver's side. They don't even know I'm in the right rear passenger. I tapped on the window with my flashlight, and that seemed to kind of like startle them. Like, oh, he's here now.
And how many people were in the car?
Three people. There was the driver, who we ended up identifying subsequently as Emmanuel Sinatis. His girlfriend was in the right front passenger. Her name was Deborah Lake. And in the rear passenger seat, right behind Deborah Lake, was a gentleman named Solomon Desreveris. So they're just looking a little bit startled, like, oh, okay, he's here. That's kind of weird, but all right. I proceed to make contact with them, and the driver tells me that he doesn't have his driver's license. So I'm just getting his, okay, well, can you give me your name? Do you have a license? Yes, I do.
Okay.
Give me your name and your date of birth, and I'll verify that you have a license. I'll verify it in the system. Okay. Well, it starts out, well, I don't remember my date of birth. Well, see, that right there, You already know that all things just start to go south from that moment forward. Yeah. Because if you don't remember your date of birth, I sure as hell know that you don't remember your social or anything like that. And then you're lying to me right off the top. Everybody knows their date of birth. The right rear passenger, he identified himself, gave me his information, as did the female also. So I told him to keep on searching for his ID. And that I would be back. And I went ahead and walked back to my vehicle.
Now, are you there by yourself? There's no other good guys with you? Okay.
No other good guys were with me at the time. We ride single man cars at Orlando. Hmm. Some agencies in some other parts of this nation might ride two man. Where I'm from now, they sometimes ride three or four man in Puerto Rico. And they have a paddy wagon that comes along and takes people into custody. But at the time, we rode single-man cars.
All right.
And I'm verifying all the information, and it comes back that the passenger, the right rear passenger, Solomon Desreveris, has a warrant out of New York. Okay, for robbery. Nothing crazy. You've been in this business long enough, you just see those. And some people might find it like, oh my God, robbery. But it's pretty traditional these days, or even back then. Pretty standard. At that moment, one of my squad mates, one of my partners, his name is George DeSalvia. He was driving on John Young southbound to go help down a broken down motorist on I-4. So he checks out with headquarters that he's with me briefly. And I fill him in on what's going on. And then I tell him, listen, we're going to walk up and we're going to take the rear passenger out of the vehicle and put him into custody. We're verifying that warrant, so we'll detain him. You know, put him in your car, if you don't mind, because I think we're going to have some issues with the driver, and I might have to put him in the, in custody in my cage in the car, and I don't want to put them together so they don't start talking. Mm-hmm. At the time, we didn't have like in-car recording systems or anything like that. And what I then thought that he had in the car was narcotics. That was my first, because we saw that so often. So we made contact with Desreveris, in the right rear passenger of the vehicle. We're standing on the embankment. He gets out of the car, goes with George, not a problem, pats him down, handcuffs him, puts him in the car. I then walk around to the driver's side. And I'm talking to this guy, and I'm like, listen, I mean, if it's just because you don't have a license, I mean, it's really, we can work around that. I mean, so I'm talking to him, but he's obstinate. He don't really want to talk. He's just being a little bit yinky. So I'm really thinking now, yeah, this guy has probably drugs in the car. So I call for a drug dog. At that time, then George is walking back up, and he proceeds to stand. It would be in the left front quarter panel of the bad guy's vehicle. He's standing facing the windshield, facing like at a 45 degree, facing the driver, facing the windshield. And I'm standing behind, like the door's still closed. And I'm standing right normally where you would stand if you just make your initial contact with them on the passengers or on the driver's side. And we have a drug dog that's coming, Kilo 95 at the time. But they're coming from far away, like Colonial and Cimarron. That's like my old district, on the opposite side of town. So then my thought was, listen, obviously this guy is lying to me. I know he has something in the car. I can either can't verify that, like that he has a license, so he's driving with no license. I can either detain him now and then go ahead and search the car afterwards, or we can just run the dog around the car. And if it alerts, then we got even more PC. But I decide to, let's go ahead and get him secure. That way the drug dog can work unimpeded. We can open up the doors. Dog can go inside. We can open up the trunk. I mean, whatnot. Without having the person just sitting in the car or anything like that. So I went ahead and proceeded to open the door to the vehicle. And I told him to go ahead and step out, which he didn't want to do. And I had ascertained already that he didn't have a license. So I went ahead and told him to, you learn tricks along the way of how to do things, right? I remember that when they taught me at the academy how to handcuff somebody, you're giving them all your verbal commands with your presence, your uniform, your battle gear. You're giving them commands, bend at the waist, hands straight out, look to your left, don't look at me. But in reality, how that goes, hey, man, could you please bend? They're gone, like 100 feet away already running. So sometimes I was like, this guy's going to run. And we're like in a pretty three-lane street, not a lot of traffic, but I don't want this guy running, gets hit by a car or something. It becomes a mess. Right. So I said, face your passenger. He was still sitting in the car. Face the passenger. Put your hands behind your back. You're being detained. And he did. He turned to face his passenger and put his hands behind his back. I went ahead and this is going to be kind of also, I mean, important, because they usually taught us to always handcuff somebody on the right side, the right hand, because the right hand is the predominant hand. And most people, they're right-handed. But how his right hand was positioned, that wasn't going to work. It was like almost pinched against the seat, but his left hand was available. Let me put a left cuff on that. So I went ahead and put a cuff on his left hand and grabbed his right hand and went to cuff him. As soon as he felt the cuff going on his right wrist, he pulled away with both hands. He's still facing, sitting. He's facing his passenger, sitting on his driver's seat. I get pulled forward onto him, kind of land on his back. But I'm not letting go of the left cuff with my left hand. At the same time, see this weapon, and I recognized it because I had one very similar. It was a Glock pistol. And he's bringing it up, and it was in between the seats. It was between the seat and the console, the driver's seat and the console, tucked in. When he broke away, when he pulled away, he stuck his right hand in there and brought it up. And as he's bringing it up, I'm like literally leaning on him. My head is against the back of his head. I'm grabbing on with the left hand, and I'm looking over his left shoulder, in essence, and I see the weapon coming up. And I see the muscle, like the blast, just the fire, and you can smell the gunpowder. And the sound, because it was right next to my left ear almost, it was like, man, it's really loud. That round went over my left shoulder, and it ended up striking George that was standing outside of the vehicle. I've been screaming that the guy had a gun. Mind you, this is taking me some time to give you the setting and the story. This happened in a matter of seconds. It's important to note that. As soon as I saw the gun, I'm screaming, he has a gun, he has a gun. I'm trying to yank back on his left hand however I can to get some control of him, hurt him in any way. And then I start to just bring, just hit him with my right hand. How I fell into him, I couldn't reach my service weapon because I was pinned almost against the seat myself. And my hand, I really couldn't get to it with a safety holster and pull out my service weapon. I couldn't do it. So he fired. And everything started to then move so slowly, ever so slowly. Because then it dawns on you, at least for me, in like a millisecond, I'm like, okay, I'm going to shoot this guy. I mean, it went from like, hey, step out of the car to, no, I'm going to shoot you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, but I got to get off of him. So I went ahead and I pushed him. I remember just pushing him with my left hand. I got some wiggle room and I was able to like shove him again with my right hand. But I'm like, I need to create some space to take my gun out. And I'm standing out of the car now. I'm like pushing myself out of the car, pushing him, going for my gun. He shoots again. That round struck me in the left shoulder, not where the vest covers. I was wearing a vest that night. It's important for those that may not know, you know, vests are like tank tops. They, where they meet up the front panel and the back panel where they connect, it's usually Velcro. Mm-hmm. You may, if you are lucky, have a little bit of Kevlar there, the material, the fabric, but it doesn't work like that. So that round went right through and through my shoulder. His weapon was a Glock 23, 40 cal. He had a 40 caliber hollow points. The initial impact was, it was bad. The exiting was even worse, because of the grains and all that, the pellets. I'm trying to back out of the car. When I got shot, I fall down. He starts to come out of the car. I'm just trying to stand up because I'm thinking in my mind, if I lay here, I'm already a step behind. He's going to shoot me right here laying down. Mm-hmm. So as I'm standing up again, he shoots. Once again, this is a matter of seconds. That round strikes me in the right shoulder, but it was worse. It was towards the joint. So I can't appreciate that you told me that your son's an orthopedic surgeon because removed from it, I'm like, oh man, yeah, I know how that goes or what they do. And that kind of spun me around. And when it spun me around, I couldn't use my arms, Murph. It's like I couldn't bring them up. Yeah, because the damage that these rounds had caused. I mean, this is not a 22 or anything like that, or it just wasn't like that. And so I remember looking, and I'm like, okay, I gotta get over this trunk area now, his back, to put it some space. And I couldn't move my right arm. I could move my left. And I'm thinking in my mind, I can unholster my gun with my left hand. I don't know how, but I'm going to do it. When I turned to try to make that move, he shot me again. And that round went literally like on, it's almost like on my right side. And that bullet snuck in between the gun belt and the vest. What that ended up doing, that round tore through some of the peripheral nerves. They call it a horse's mane that comes out of your spinal cord. And it struck my vertebrae at the L3 level. And then it proceeded to travel up the bone marrow. And then your main spinal cord, and I learned this through the years of therapy, your main cord ends at L1. Then it branches out into like a horse's mane, a bunch of nerves going every which way. As it was going to go into the L1 area, it shifted, went out, and it went into my chest cavity through my right lung. And just sat there. The problem was that as soon as it cut those nerves and it hit the vertebrae, my legs were gone. I just toppled down. And it's a very crazy feeling. I would say probably at that point in time, it started to become a little bit of an overload because then I'm trying to tell my legs, okay, you got to move. I mean, you've always been taught you move and you shoot. Move and shoot. If you stay still, you're going to be a sitting duck. You got to move. But my legs are not responding. They're just not working. It's just not happening. So I'm trying to process all that. And this guy, I'm on my belly now, and I'm trying to just stand up with my left arm, like push myself off of the pavement. And because my right arm is like pinned under me, my legs are not working. And he just unloads four more rounds right into my back. That seemed like it took forever. But I remember thinking, okay, I got to get a hold of my radio. My radio was on my mic was on my right lapel, my right shoulder, because I'm right-handed. But I couldn't move my right arm to get to it. So I'm thinking, I got to get to it somehow. That's my only lifeline here at that moment. But then in between, and this really did hurt. He put the muzzle of the pistol right up against my skull, right up against my head. And it was hot, man. That like burned. And then he pulled the trigger again. And that gave me this, you can't see it now, but I have a nice scar on the top of my head right here. And that ended up blowing out a chunk of my skull. And it just so happened that the bullet went at an angle that it didn't go into my brain, just went at an angle. And that made my head like ricochet off the pavement, got a cut on over my eye. I'm bleeding all over the place now for sure. And that hurt because it felt like somebody just hit me with a baseball bat on top of the head. That was painful. At that point in time, I'm pushing myself off with my left hand and I'm trying to just roll over because I'm thinking, I'm processing now. Okay. I might die out here. It looks like that, but you got to always try, right? You always got to fight. You always got to try. You just can't, I can't just lay here. I got to try something. Maybe I can reach this guy with my left hand and grab his leg and bite him. I mean, I'm just going through things in my mind. So when I roll over, I see him. He ran back to George. And I can see George's leg. I can't see the upper torso, just his lower torso. He's laying on the ground. And he shot him again. Believe it or not, I was counting bullets. And just based on my experience, and for those few times in my life that I've been right about something, this is one of them. I figured he had 10 bullets, and he did. That was his 10th one. He had shot me 8 times and George twice at that moment. Then when I saw him, when I heard the click, because I could hear it, and there's no more rounds, and he's just like hovering over him. I see him, like he puts the gun away, and he leans into George, and he grabs his gun, his service weapon, and starts to yank on his holster. He was able to undo the top snap, just not the back snap, the safety one. He wasn't able to do that. At that point in time, he runs back to the car. In the meantime, I'm on the radio. And I'm calling. It was at the time, my unit was 154. So it was 154, signal 43, which means officer needs immediate assistance. Life and death matters, you know, shots fired. So by then, everybody's coming. It doesn't take up more than a few seconds. You hear the sirens. He runs to his car to get in and drive away. The female is still in the car, from what I can tell. The bad guy, Des Riveras, is still in the back of the cage of our car. But what he didn't realize, and to see, this is going to tell you, once again, the hand of God, because it's not something I normally did or would have ever thought to do, just one of those things. When he pulled away, and I'm grabbing on with my left hand. My left hand, I'm holding onto the spare cuff and he's pulling away and we're in the car in those few seconds as we're tussling and he's moving and flailing. My hand just happened to, when I looked to my left, I'm looking at his hand and the cuffs and the gun. I see his keys that are in the ignition. And with like my pinky and my ring finger, I was able to like latch onto those. And in the tussling, I was able to pull them out and I kept them in my hand. So I had the keys to the car in my hand. When I was trying to roll over, I tucked them into my gun belt. What? So when he goes to get in the car and drive away, he can't drive away because I got the keys. He takes off on foot. And then a manhunt ensues where he was found the next morning. At that point in time, had a deputy arrive on the scene from what I was told subsequently, and he's working on George. I had one of my other squad mates. He showed up first on the scene. I could hear him on the radio. Two officers are down. People get here. And then I remember another officer who later on passed away. His name is Carl Smith. Carl Smith got to the scene and he grabs me and drags me over to like my car, to the wheel well. And he like sits me up against the tire. The front left tire. He's just like slapping me on the face, making sure I'm not passing out and trying to get a description. And I was conscious. I was conscious the whole time. OFD, the fire department, they responded within minutes. They, for all they say that they take care of their patients on the field, I'm going to have to differ with these guys on this one. Love them to death, but they did exactly what they needed to do to save my life. Literally, Murph, they scooped me up by my legs, which that really hurt, and by my torso. They grabbed me. They threw me on a gurney, threw me in the ambulance. Within minutes, I was at Orlando Regional Medical Center, which is our trauma center, kind of like what Jackson Memorial is down in South Florida.
Yeah.
And I was getting, my boots were getting cut off of me, my pants, my shirt, my vest. And then the hard work began. I asked my squad mate that was with me in the ambulance, Ms. Stetzel, if George was alive. And he says he wasn't sure at the time. Later on, when my wife responded to the hospital, I asked her, and because I was still conscious, and she told me that he had passed. And the reality is, before he even hit the ground,
he was gone. That first
shot. Oh, yeah, he was gone. He was gone. And this guy ended up throwing the pistol in a lake called Clear Lake. It's about a mile down the road on the left-hand side of the street. Mm-hmm. And it was found months later with some volunteers and some metal detectors. And he holed himself up in an abandoned house. And he was found by a trooper at an Orange County Sheriff's Deputy K-9. Now, mind you, at that time, I was in surgery. And the only reason, or the main reason, not the only, but the main reason why they were able to identify him. Remember that cuff that I put on his left hand? He wasn't able to take it off. So he double cuffed himself. So when they found him, he was double cuffed. And I had indicated as such that I had cuffed him once. So he had handcuffs on. He just couldn't get him off. His girlfriend, which was the girl in the front, she walked up to one of our units in the perimeter down the road and asked if they could call her a cab. And I remember that she was wearing like a yellow outfit, and I had given that description of her. Mm-hmm. So as soon as she walked up to the officer, they detained her.
Absolutely.
We're talking to her. If they were smart, we would never catch them, right? And then the guy who was, I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. Who would do that? Go to the front desk and have them call you a cab. No, you go to the officer on the perimeter, in the perimeter. Hey, can you call me a cab, please? Really? Okay. How does that work? I can laugh about it. And I'm like, really? And there's no honor amongst thieves. He could have let his buddy out of the car, but he left him there. He was in the cage when other units got there. He ended up testifying against the shooter. Various things that we learned subsequently was that he was from a gang. They were up here doing some crimes. They're from a gang in South Florida, and they were up here just doing crimes. They had robbed a few fast food restaurants, establishments. They had robbed where they got their weapons, this Cash America Pawn close to Orange Blossom Trail and Americana Boulevard, the west side. Mm-hmm. And interesting enough that we found out through testimony when it went to trial was that one of the ladies that worked at the Cash America Pawn, she was from Cuba, and she had done the trek to the United States on a raft. And she testified that she would rather, that the way that this guy terrorized her when he was committing his robbery, that she would rather go through that trip on a raft with limited provisions, limited water, limited food, not knowing if you're going to make it or not. She'd rather take the chance and do that again than have to be terrorized by him. We know that when I initiated the stop, he turned to the passenger in the back, to this Rivera's, and he asked him, well, he told him, when the cracker walks up, wet the cracker. This Rivera's didn't want to do that. But this Rivera's didn't want to snitch on his buddy neither, so he didn't say anything. So then this Rivera's told him no, so he was going to do it. The plan was, when I walked up, just open fire when I was by the window. But it got all thrown off when I did something that I never do, which was walk up the embankment on the right side of the road. Yeah. And the only reason why I did that, and it was just weird, because I always walked up on the driver's side. And this time I'm like, I'm just going to walk up on the passenger side. I want to get out of the roadway. It wasn't even a lot of traffic to begin with. And I'm like, I'm just going to get out of the roadway. And I did. it ended up saving my life, more than likely. I never make it a habit of trying to get it in car keys from anybody. But if they drive away, hey, back in the day, you probably have a good car chase that you can get into it. And those were fun, you know?
Yeah.
So, but that night, I'm like, I mean, in the whole craziness of it, I grabbed the keys. The fact that I cuffed him in the left, he was not going to be handcuffed on the right. He couldn't be handcuffed on the right because he needed that hand free to shoot.
Right.
So more than likely, had I cuffed the right, try to cuff the right hand, that wasn't going to work. So there's a lot of things that happened that I normally didn't do normally that I did that I believe ended up saving my life. And I shouldn't even be here. I mean, that's the truth.
It's amazing that you are hit 8 times. Did any of those rounds, those last 4 rounds, did any of those hit your vest?
Yeah, they all did.
So they did save you.
If I had not been wearing a vest, I would not be here.
Yeah.
Because the damage would have been too extensive. But what people don't know also, I mean, some of them know, those in our community know, but somebody who is not in law enforcement, you know, like you watch, I don't know, the Avengers and you see Iron Man, right? And he gets shot and the bullets that bounce off of him. A vest doesn't work like that. The round still pushes into you. In this case, being hollow points, the round expands like a claw. So it hits the vest because it's just material that's woven together. You only have your steel plate in the front and it expands, but that's getting pushed into you.
Mm-hmm.
It'll hold. It won't break through the vest, but it's getting pushed into you. So it creates a puncture wound no matter what, which was one of the things that my surgeon had to contend with, because not only did I have pellets from the rounds, the one that snuck in and the ones from my shoulders, but there was a lot of material like Kevlar, the material that they had to try to clean out of my spine, out of my back. And the reality is they were not able to get all of it, you know, so it kind of, it's actually now all these years removed. When I go back for a checkup, x-ray or something, they're kind of neat because they kind of like illuminate. Like it's like they're like fluorescent. They like shine. But you see them all over. It's kind of weird. But
so that part of Eddie Diaz is bulletproof.
Listen, I don't even know. I am a very blessed and fortunate individual. And like we talked about earlier, your days are, I really do believe that God knows what your days are on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
From the moment that you're born to the moment you got to go.
Yep.
And it just wasn't my time to go. It just wasn't.
So now you're paralyzed now. Your legs aren't working.
I woke up about 4 days later. I'll share this with you too, really quick. Those chest tubes, those things hurt like crazy. I remember my trauma surgeon at ORMC, they had pushed morphine because I was in so much pain, but they didn't realize that my lung had collapsed. So that was causing what's called a tension pneumothorax. So to relieve that pressure, they got to stick a chest tube in you. Well, the way to do that, think of an arrow and they put the arrow right in between your ribs, usually like second or third rib, and then they punch it in, but they cannot give you anything, any anesthetic for that because you're already in respiratory distress.
Right.
So they can't push any kind of painkiller because those are respiratory depressants. And I remember that I screamed so loud on that. And I told the doctor, I probably told him a bunch of expletives and that if I could kill him, I would, because I was like, man. And then they put this hose into your side to let your chest cavity drain. After that, sometime thereafter, I passed out, woke up 4 days later. And that is probably one of the hardest conversations that I've had in my life, because it just so happens that the neurosurgeon, he was there, and my wife was there. I was there. My parents were there. I asked them to step out of the room. I remember that. I don't even know why I did that. I just wanted it to just be my wife and I, really. And the doctors told me, he goes, Eddie, you're paralyzed, waist down. I knew enough to know that there was no cure for that. So I didn't even need to ask that question. I only asked, well, how much better could it get? And he was like, we don't know. It's a matter of time. Time and therapy, work and time. I said, okay. And then, and followed up, you know, typical guy. So can I have children? That was like my second question. Typical guy, Murph. I'm like, okay, can we move on past the legs? That's fine. How about the children part? Okay. That's let's go to the important things. Right. And he was like, I don't know if you are able to have kids or not. He goes, right now, at the time, and people may or may not know this, not only when you're paralyzed do you lose your ability to walk, but you lose your ability to use your bowel and bladder.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't go to the bathroom like you would. And so I will tell you, it was to my ego as a man, as a person, as a human being, it was very humbling. It was very humbling. And my wife, we had been married for a year and a half. She's listening. I mean, she's right there. And he said he was sorry. And I remember he left the room and I just stayed with her. And that probably brought a lot of despair at the time into my life. Because now I knew that George was gone. So that had happened. I knew that my career was done. I'd never be a cop again. But then now you're talking that the use of my legs is in question. The use of my bowel and bladder is in question. And even the ability to have children, that's in question. So I remember, you know, I had this conversation with Nancy, you know, and I think I mentioned it too. You know, it wasn't what she signed up for, at least in my own mind, in my own simplistic way of looking at things. This is not what she signed up for. I mean, we don't know what challenges I'm going to have in the future.
Right.
It's not fair to her. You know, and I told her, I go, you know, if you want to go, maybe we should get divorced. Maybe you can go your way and have a good life. You can meet somebody else and have a fine life. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to deal with all the stuff, all the crap, all the baggage that has just been unloaded at your doorstep. At your feet, because the reality is, and I told her, I do not know how, but I can tell you, I'm not the same person that I was. I mean, I know how in some ways, but I do not know how in other ways. I'm not the same person that I was 4 days ago. That dead and gone. Things have changed. I'm sure she, if I remember correctly, she said some expletives to me, and she was like, pretty much kind of like that she would mess me up if I ever brought that topic of conversation up again, if I ever gave that suggestion. And I was like, listen, just kind of think about it. And she kind of like gave me the look like she was about to hurt me even more hurt than I was. And I was like, all right, I'll leave it alone. Okay, fine. We won't go there anymore. And, you know, in that realm, fast forward, we've been together now for 31 years.
That's why I called her an unsung hero earlier, because I knew how this story is going to play out.
She's a champ. But then all the other hard work started. I mean, because we had a couple of trials to deal with this guy. The state attorney was taking over the murder of a law enforcement officer and the attempted murder of another one. But then, funny thing, the feds got involved. And I love you guys for this one thing, man. If there's any reason why I love you, you guys, like, for example, and people got to realize, for at the state level, we call it, let's say it's robbery. Mm-hmm. You guys call it interfering with interstate commerce. And it sounds nice and fancy. And all that does, it adds like another 20 years to your sentence, where at the state level, it was 5. With the feds, is 20. And it's all... And had an agent from the ATF. I won't say her name here, but she retired already. And she is working with one of the assistant U.S. attorneys. I'll say his name. His name is Matthew Perry, Matt Perry. He's over in Tampa now. I think he's in charge of training for the attorneys down there. But this guy, top notch for the feds. I mean, and he just... felt like he needed to get involved. The agent from the ATF got involved. And because they had stolen weapons, that made it a ATF issue, a federal issue. And because they've done things in various jurisdictions and whatnot. And so they got involved. And then locally, it was Jeff Ashton. He's been involved in some other high-profile cases. But at the time, he was the lead state attorney that took over for my case. And top notch. I couldn't ask for more. Him and Matthew Perry, Matthew served as his co-counsel at the state level. And then he helped Matthew at the federal level. So they kind of, I mean, it was seamless. It was great.
Boy, it should be.
I mean, it was phenomenal. I mean, he got convicted and he received, at the time, I want to say it was about 185 years, the federal level. He ended up getting at the state level convicted. The state was looking for the death penalty, but it's hard. It's hard. And I've come to realize that and reconcile it in my own mind. It's hard to get a jury, 12 jurors, that are just good, law-abiding, hardworking people.
Mm-hmm.
And for you to ask them to put somebody to death and execute them, it's hard. Not everybody sees things like you and I see things, maybe. So he was given life in prison without parole for both the murder and the attempted murder. And the good thing about that is that he went through his appeal in a relatively short fashion, and it was closed, and we could move on. We can move on forward. If we were dealing with a death penalty case, we would be obviously revisiting this
forever.
Right now. No issues with how it was handled. I wish some outcomes might have been different in relation to sentencing, but listen. We had a hearing not that long ago because he was looking to reduce, by some Supreme Court decision, he was going to reduce the amount of years that he had been held by the feds by like 35 years. It wasn't going to mean anything. So it went from like 185 to 150. But I guess when you have time in your hands,
and you found Jesus,
you want to make sure that you exhaust all possibilities. His sentence got reduced to 150 years or something like that. So it's funny because when you look him up at the state level, he has a nice hold by the U.S. Marshals after the life sentences. So
good.
He's going to die in a pine box. You know what? Nobody will ever convince me. Yes, you adapt to prison living, but you adapt out of necessity. But it's not normal for human beings to live caged up like that either. It's not easy living. It's just not.
And so, with no hope of ever getting out.
Could you imagine? I mean, you are a young man. He was in his early 20s, 20, something like that.
Wow.
And the rest of your life is done, Murph.
Yep.
Your life is done. There's no hope for anything. There's no Mother's Day, no Christmas, no Thanksgiving, no birthdays, mm-hmm. no having a family, not enjoying fresh air. I mean,
he didn't remember when his birthday was anyway. So
that would not happen.
I'm very happy that he will never be on the streets again. Honestly, he shouldn't be on our earth as an alive person,
shouldn't.
In my opinion. But so you're in the hospital and, I don't want to steal your thunder here, but how long did it take you before you proved the doctors wrong and started walking again?
It took about 2 years, years. And I'll say this. I mean, I can't run and I cannot jump. But I do walk with a cane. I mean, probably physically doing.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, my time with the service with the Marines and my time going through the academy and all the foot chases I had in OPD and all the altercations, that was child's play as compared to learning how to walk again. I spent countless, countless, countless hours on the parallel bars, learning how to balance, learning how to take a step. Squeeze your glutes, all these things that your body just does automatically when you take a step. You don't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I had to relearn. I always joked with my wife that there's a reason why none of us remember when we learn how to walk when we were little kids, when we were little toddlers, because it's like God wipes it from our memory bank because it's so damn hard. It's like he doesn't want us to start off life with that hard event. I was thinking about it, but it is true. I mean, it was super hard, super hard. And a lot of blood, a lot of sweat, a lot of tears.
Even imagine.
A lot of countless hours just trying to get better physically, mentally. And my whole thing was this. I knew that my life had changed. I knew that it was never going to be the same. I knew that I couldn't be a cop anymore. I knew that I couldn't run. I couldn't jump. That was well established, but I felt that I can still move forward. It's a game of inches for me at the time. I can move forward. And if I can just do a little bit better, an inch better, for example, in where I got from yesterday to today, and to, from today to tomorrow, do another inch or take another step. It wasn't anything that was transcendent. I mean, it wasn't anything that was going to, but for me, it was. And it was just the concept of not giving up, not giving in. Yes, something was taken from me, but you didn't take all that you could have taken,
right?
Which was my life and my livelihood per se. Because I mean, I can still go out and do things in life. And it was, but it was hard. I mean, it was about 2 years. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I was at Shepherd's Hospital, I was at OMC for 10 days and then I went to Shepherd's for 6 weeks. When I was at Shepherd's, they were always working on me on the whole bowel thing. Because they teach you at Shepherd to live with your disability. So they teach you how to take care of yourself, your basic needs and whatnot.
But
my wife was always, you got to like the visualization. You got to try. You got to try. She, listen, this woman.
She's your biggest cheerleader. Woman,
she, I mean, geez, I would not be a quarter of the man that I am without her. It just wouldn't happen. It just would not be. Yeah, it's an impossibility. And I remember that I was trying to go to the bathroom, right? And then all of a sudden I go. I haven't gone to the bathroom now in almost like 6 weeks, like on my own. So I remember, I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. I went to the bathroom. So I grabbed the nurse's, the emergency cord in the bathroom, and I'm yanking on that thing. All of a sudden, I'm sitting on the toilet, and these three nurses roll in, right? And I'm like, I went to the bathroom. I went to the bathroom. I went to the bathroom. I got these three women, never met me probably. They're cheering for me like, oh, no, it's so good, so good. So then I'm like, this is where my mind was at. I'm like, so what do I do? And it was funny because one of them like looks at me like,
forget how to wipe yourself.
Wipe yourself. And I'm like, yes, that's right. So you know, so that happened. And then that came back first. My bladder took a little bit longer, but it was funny because my urologist back home always used to say, it's going to come back because you're standing up. I was had started to stand up. And he goes, if we get you standing, that bladder's going to come back. It's going to come back. It's going to come back. So I was, remember that, my wife again, when you go pee, just visualize when you're, one day just starts to come back.
Yeah.
So go to the doctor, checks me out, does a bunch of testing and realizes why it came back. And I'll tell you that in a second, which is crazy. But the point was that weekend, Gladiator was playing in the movie theater. And I told my wife, oh man, I want to go see Gladiator. Yep. And I go, I want to drink the biggest size Coke that they have. Because I always watched what I drank when I went out in public, because I don't want to be catheterizing out in public, some public restroom. So she's like, okay. So I get the biggest Coke, biggest tub of popcorn. This movie's long, right? So halfway through the movie, I'm like, oh, I got to go pee. And I was so excited. I'm like, oh, I got to go pee. This is great. I was like, I don't care. I was missing part of the movie. I'm just happy I'm going to go pee. So I go to the bathroom. And you know, male etiquette. You go to the bathroom. There's a guy at the urinal. You don't just roll right up to the guy in the urinal right next to him. You just kind of like leave a urinal in between, all that stuff.
Yep.
Oh, no, hell no. I don't give a damn because I was just so damn happy that I was peeing. So I roll up right on this dude, right? And I'm standing right next to him. And he already is kind of like, I can feel like he's side-eyeing me. And then I just turn to him and I just smile at him as I'm peeing in the urinal next. I'm smiling at him. And I go, doesn't it feel so good to pee? And the guy looks at me and goes, man, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, so many things. You don't even know. He got out of there so quick.
Oh, yeah.
He's like the roadrunner. He was out of there. But
wash your hands. I don't have time to wash my hands. I got to get away from this guy.
I got to go. But that took me, I mean, a few years. And I went through the whole thing, a wheelchair, a couple of quad canes, a quad cane and a single cane, two single canes, and then to what I used to today, which is a single cane.
Yeah.
And it's... listen, it's been a blessing. And then the issue was, can we have kids? And that's another one. That's another story because, you know, I go to the doctor and, you know, he wants me to bring him in a specimen that they were going to test out. So I'm like, oh, really? Okay. So I go home, you know, I get my little specimen cup and Nancy's at work. I'm like, okay. So he goes, you got to get it in back to me within a certain amount of time, you know, for it to be viable. I said, okay, fine. So then I time it where I'm going to drop it off They have like a little drop area during lunchtime. So I'm like, there's nobody there. There's like minimal people there, minimal staff. I'm crawling in with my sample cup. I don't want everybody to see me. Man, Murph, of all the days, they asked for a freaking takeout. They got Subway. So these three women are at the front desk eating their subs when I'm rolling in with my specimen sample. And oh my, I was like, I have my hat on. I'm like, at the time, it didn't happen as often as it does today, especially here in the City Beautiful, right? So all of a sudden, it was like this officer got shot was a big deal. And he survived. Mm-hmm. It was a big deal. It was a lot of media coverage, a lot of things. So they knew me because they see me in the office before. Yeah. So they're like, Officer Diaz, loudest, get out. And I'm just trying to give my little sample and get out of there and not be seen. But make a long story short, that was good too. And we've been married now for 31 years. We have two children, 17 and a 21-year-old. And the girl is 21, the boy is 17. And listen, it hasn't been easy because as well as I recovered, I neglected my mental health for the longest time. Kind of like that macho bravado kind of thing. I can go at it alone. I don't need anybody. I did that when I was at Shepherd, and they offered for me to talk to a shrink or someone. That happened also when I was going through the whole workers' comp and retirement thing. Talked to the shrink. Really didn't want to because my whole thing was, what do they know? You're not a cop. You're not part of my community. You don't know what I've been through. And really, in my own stubborn and ignorant way, that's exactly what I needed. I needed to talk to somebody who was unbiased, who was on the outside looking in, who could give me good advice, who would just even hear me or just give me the strategies or just plant the seeds in my mind that with time would grow so I could be more successful quickly, that it wouldn't take as long. And but I didn't listen. So that took a while. That took a while until I got to where I'm at. And I may be able to sit here, chat with you about it, and be forthcoming. So.
And I read when I was doing some research on you that you've done some public speaking, and you primarily talk about forgiveness.
Yeah.
So have you forgiven the shooter?
You know, I like to say that I have. I like to say that I have. Well, let's go back. I used to think that I had. Mm-hmm. Have I done it today? Yes. I'm in a different place, mentally, physically. I'm not the same man that I used to be. And for the better. I mean, I would hope. And the reason why, obviously, I detest what he did. I hold him accountable for what he did. Based on my faith, is there a chance that I'll see him again someday in paradise? Well, there is that chance, but there's probably a great probability that I won't, knowing him. Really, you know what? That's not my job. My job is, that's God's job. God will take care of that. That's a battle that I learned a long time ago that I can't fight. It's just not, I'm not equipped to do that. So, I mean, have I forgiven him? Yes. I think that allowed me to be able to heal.
I think so too.
Because in the forgiveness of it, it doesn't mean that I condone or accept or agree with what he did. I just refuse to let any sort of hatred, negative feelings dominate my life towards him. Because then I feel that would not allow me to get right. Then that would affect me and my family. And the thing was this, when I realized that, and I realized how that was affecting my wife, my children, and myself, I cannot let this guy win.
Right.
And if I held on to that, I'm letting him win in a sense. That's how at least I see it. And I don't want this guy to have any sort of control or any sort of power or his memory or anything over me. So
I agree.
Back then, I thought I had. I really hadn't. It took me a while. It took a bit. But I came to the conclusion, he's tried to get moved to the feds to be incarcerated in the federal system a number of times, and it's always been denied. Because the state system, the Fed is not good. But the state is a little bit worse, a lot worse. So that's not easy living. I can only imagine what he goes through. Of course, those are his consequences. He made his choices. Right. And he doesn't get a chance to choose his consequences. That's the bet he made. That's the bet he lays on. Good luck with that. Maybe God can help you with that. But I mean, I did do some public speaking, and I found that every step of the way, it helped me to heal. I had the opportunity to go to the academy a few times and talk about my incident. And I felt every single time, Murph, it's helped me to heal. And even to this day, right now, I'm sure that I will walk away from this and be like, you know what? I'm glad I had a chance to tell my story. And if it can help somebody, if maybe there's an officer out there that listens to it and decides, I'm going to start to walk down the embankment a little bit instead of, and if that helps them, and even if they never really know if that saved their life or not, then so be it.
And it's so easy to get complacent out there. So easy.
It is, especially like when you do it day in and day out, and it's the same, you fall into this routine, and then you get complacent and you get cocky. I've seen it all, done it all already. I've chased out every perp that there is. You gotta be humble and be willing to learn every day and just be vigilant. I mean, just head on a swivel, as they say. So
very quickly, tell everybody what you're doing now, because I love the way you, when I ask you that when we first talked, I love this answer.
Listen, I am your bona fide basketball dad. I am a retired individual who is a bona fide basketball dad. I am that guy that you see on the stands. The only difference is I keep my mouth shut.
Yeah.
I don't do all the scream. Well, sometimes I yell when my son does a good play. I mean, he's 17 now. He's been playing ball.
How tall is he?
He's 6'8". Wow. 6'8". And, you know, he was a big baby to begin with. I mean, he was like 10, 12 when he was born. 10 pounds, 12 ounces. He was huge.
Wow.
I'm telling you, I mean, I did well. I did my job well, you know. My wife rolls her eyes when I say that, you know.
There's a lot of comments I can make on that, but I'm not.
You know, and I worked for the school system for a while. I took some time off after I retired from OPD, and I was focused on my rehab. And then we had our first child, our daughter, and I decided to stay home and be a stay-at-home dad for her. Then we decided to have our second born, and I decided, well, I gave, you know, Sydney the same opportunity I'm going to give Ethan. So I stayed home for another bit. Stay-at-home dad. And listen, was it challenging? Yes. I never changed so many diapers in my life. Heated up so many bottles of formula and milk and fed so many Chef Boyardee meals. But listen, those raviolis, those were good. But it gave my children and myself the opportunity. God gifted me that.
Yeah.
To do something that a lot of dads can't do.
Yeah.
And then when they were a little bit older, then I had the opportunity to go back, and I worked for the school system in Seminole County. And then I worked there for quite a few years. And then as the whole pandemic thing happened and whatnot, then I went ahead and retired. And then my son has been playing ball since he was little. He kind of like picked it up on his own. I've never played ball. I was never a basketball player. He kind of like picked it up and ran with it. He had like one of those little tykes. Oops. And nowadays, I mean, he is much better than I have ever told him, or that I would care to admit to him. But he is pretty good. I think he'll probably go on to the next level after high school and play. So
sweet.
I hope to be able to chase him around during March Madness and go visit him wherever he's at and go watch him play. So
do you want him to go to Florida State?
Listen, I would love for him to go to Florida State, but see, the problem is that these children have a mind of their own, Murph, and
and trust me, I know.
I'm like, hold on a second. I'm like, I went to Florida State for all the wrong reasons, and it turned out beautifully. Why can't you just go to Florida State for all the right reasons, Dad? I got to look at all my options, and so he's. I think that he would do well, and he's gone up there and scoped it out. He'll probably do a camp with Leonard Hamilton next summer. He's a basketball coach. And I think he would love it to go up there and be part of Seminole Nation. He'll be a legacy if he did. And you know, I think he could do a lot of good things. Like my parents broke their heart when I decided not to go to college and join the military. I'm kind of giving him that. He is going to go to college because he wants to play. So I'm just kind of like, we'll help him navigate where is his best opportunity. But I'm kind of like leaving it up to him. Although I will tell you, I draw the line. If it's University of Miami Hurricanes or the Gators, I'm just going to have to – I don't know what to do, Murph. I'm going to go back through mental health treatment. I'm going to have to talk to somebody about that because that's not going to go well.
That's funny. That's funny.
We'll see.
I tell you what, Eddie, it's your story. Thank you for I mean, being so transparent, going down into the weeds and telling us the things you went through. I can't imagine that it's an easy story to tell. But the and on top of that, 4 bronze stars in the military, holy cow. It's you have lived a life that they make movies out of. It's just your
you
patriotism.
Have, my friend. You have.
Well, that's just, you know, believe me, it wasn't anything about me. It was
I was telling my kid, and like I told you, I was like, listen, I'm gonna talk to Steve Murphy and he was like, oh, so I showed him and he knew exactly. I told my dad, he knew exactly. And then I told my daughter, I got told, and she was like, is Pascal gonna be there? I was no, that's not important.
Pedro played that other guy. What's his hobby?
No, he's not gonna be there. It's really, thank you for giving me the opportunity to just, like I said, tell my story. Hopefully people find that amongst the serious topics or aspects, they find the humor and hopefully it helps somebody else and maybe it motivates somebody. Because the main thing is, Murph, we always got to keep on moving forward. It's not going to ever be easy. There's nothing easy about life. It's not meant to be easy.
At the beginning, this is a story of resilience, of recovery, of regaining your life, of appreciating what you've been given a second chance to do. You are a hero, hero in every sense of the word. You're a patriot. You served your country. Then you came and served your local community. Even in the school system, you continue to serve the public here. So can't think of enough acronyms to put you on that pedestal. But
basketball,
believe me,
dad.
Brother,
basketball,
you are
dad.
Up there.
Basketball,
I love
dad.
It. I love it.
That's all I am. Basketball, dad.
Just and with your permission, I would like to dedicate today's episode to Officer George DeSalvia, who
absolutely
gave his life protecting our community.
He really is. I mean, listen, he gave a little bit. He gave it all. And that's the reality. That's a fact. Yeah. And if there's ever anybody that is a hero, it's him. He didn't need to stop.
Exactly.
To check up on me as we normally did. We would always back up each other, and whether it was called for or not.
Yep.
He was just on his way to help somebody else who was broken down on I-4, broken down motorist, and he decided to stop. And he sacrificed everything. And it had not been for him, Lord knows where I would be, because the reality is he was wounded twice, and I don't know if I would have had it in me to be able to sustain 2 more wounds. I just don't know, Murph. Probably not, to be honest with you. And he is the real hero, and it's really men like him, men and women like him, who are willing to do the things that a lot of people are not willing to do or won't do for our country, for our state, for our local communities in different ways, but in law enforcement work, this is the kind of guy, he's running to the gunfire when others run away from it. He's running into the burning building when people are running out of it, it's really, it's men like him. It's been proven through our history as a nation, and it's men like him, and it'll be men like him and women like him that will, hopefully make sure that our constitutional republic endures our freedoms and our way of life, our American way of life.
I couldn't say it any better, brother. So God bless you.
God bless you too.
And your family. Nancy, you're on this pedestal. Nancy's just right here. I mean,
she is way, like, there's not even, she is off the charts, and I'm in my infancy stage. I'm in my diapers, and she's like, she's off the chain.
Well, listen, Eric, basketball dad, hang on for just a minute. And to all our regular listeners, stand by for the debrief. Wow. What an inspirational story Eddie Diaz has. And what a shame and an ordeal that he had to go through such a terrifying experience simply because he was doing his job as a police officer and serving the public. I think one of the most ironic things about Eddie almost being murdered that fateful night in 2000 is that it happened after he survived multiple combat situations in Iraq. Eddie received 4 Bronze Stars. 4 Bronze Stars for his actions in combat, under fire, helping to rescue and save his brothers in arms. You heard what he said. He wasn't just running up and moving the injured back to a safer location. Some of the wounded had to be treated first before they could be moved. Right there where they got shot, right there where the enemy is still shooting at you. What kind of bravery and dedication does that take? Whoa. Some of you may ask, what's a Bronze Star? And what do you have to do to get one? Well, here's your answer. The Bronze Star Medal is the 4th highest individual military award. It may be awarded for acts of heroism, acts of merit, or meritorious service in a combat zone. Now, my understanding is that the Bronze Star comes after the Congressional Medal of Honor, the Distinguished Service Cross, and the Silver Star. So now you know. Whenever I hear about a police officer being wounded or killed in the line of duty, man, I get ramped up. My legs start bouncing. They're bouncing right now. I may start sweating. I get tunnel vision. In my mind's eye, I'm trying to envision the location and what happened. Honestly, it's not that great of a feeling. Well, while editing Eddie's interview, I listened to him recounting the night he was shot, and all those reactions started again. And then Eddie sent me a copy of the dispatcher recording from that night on February 3rd, 2000. Talk about nerve-wracking. Even though the attempted murder of Eddie Diaz happened 24 years ago, as I'm listening to the recording, man, I wanted to jump up, get in my truck, and head over to the scene just so I could try to help him out. After listening to that tape, I had to stop everything and calm down. And that's true. I'm honored that Eddie shared that with me, but it brings back tons of memories, and not all of them are good memories. If you will, just think back what Eddie went through that night. What did he do wrong? What could he have done differently? What would you have done? And of course, you and I are looking at this with the benefit of hindsight, aren't we? So I'm certainly not second-guessing Eddie here, but this is a learning experience for all of us in so many ways. But do you think you would have had the presence of mind to save yourself after being shot 8 times, some at point-blank range, and one of those shots was point-blank to the head? Unbelievable. Would you have removed those keys from the murderer's car during that struggle and then had the presence of mind to hide them in your waistband as you're fighting for your life? Would you even think of that? I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have. Having been shot so many times, would you or I have the stamina and wherewithal to physically get to your radio and call for backup, to call for life-saving help? As I was making my notes for this debrief, I listened to the radio call again from that night. I heard Eddie call out for the traffic stop. Then I heard George DeSalvia check out with Eddie. Didn't have to be there. He was just backing up a brother officer. I heard the call for a drug detection dog. I had to stop at this point and just listen. The leg bouncing and the sweats, they all started again. My heartbeat went up quickly. Goosebumps popped up on my arms. And then I've got to be honest, tears came to my eyes as I heard the urgency in Eddie's voice calling, "Signal 43, shots fired." And then another time he reports that he's been shot. The Signal 43 code, just so you know, is a quick way for officers to notify dispatch and other officers then that they are in immediate need of emergency help. Man, Signal 43, look out, here they come. The first officer on scene reported that there were 2 officers down. That's the first thing he saw when he arrived. And then you hear responding units with sirens blaring in the background. They start to develop a plan to take care of business. Now, from experience, I'll tell you, every officer that heard that Signal 43 shots fired call, they were on their way as fast as they could get there to help out a brother officer or sister officer. Then I heard that the Orlando Fire Department was responding. And if you remember, Eddie told us they were the ones who saved his life. They were the ones that got him on that stretcher immediately and rushed him straight to the Orlando Trauma Center as quickly as they possibly could. Now, I'm guessing they conducted a quick triage of Eddie's conditions and realized his best bet to survive was to get to the trauma center ASAP. And, you know, they called the hospital in advance, let them know they've got a severely injured police officer with multiple gunshot wounds on the way in, even before Eddie ever arrived. You know, in my opinion, and I'm sure Eddie would agree, it's a miracle that God saved his life that night. But think about this. The doctors told Eddie he was paralyzed from the waist down, and they didn't know if he would ever be able to walk again. Tell me that wouldn't take the wind out of your sails. 10 days in the Orlando hospital, the trauma center, then 6 weeks at the Shepherd Center in Atlanta to teach Eddie how to live with his new disabilities. I can only imagine it takes a massive amount of courage to face those facts and continue forward. But what do you think was one of Eddie's primary motivating factors in all this? Well, remember his talk with his wife, Nancy, in the hospital? Because of his new physical and mental condition, Eddie, you know, did the right thing, I think. He offered her a divorce so she could get on with her life and not be burdened with his new challenges. And this is what almost led to Eddie's immediate death. As big of a hero as Eddie is, not only for repeatedly facing danger and serving his fellow man, Nancy is right up there also, next to Eddie. I'm telling you, I refer to our family members as the unsung heroes in all of this. I mean, you heard Eddie say he thought Nancy might hurt him even more for suggesting such a thing. When they married, they both took an oath to support each other in sickness and in health, for richer or poorer, until death do us part, right? I mean, I took that same oath. Nancy took that oath personally, and when the time came, she lived up to what she said. Now, that's a dedicated wife, the unsung hero. Nancy, I'm as proud of you as I am of Eddie. After all of this, everything Eddie went through, the pain, the anguish, bitterness, doubting, uncertainty, the recovery, and moving forward with a new way of life, if you went through all that, would you have been able to forgive the scumbag that caused it all? You know, the guy that tried to murder you? Honestly, I'm not sure I could. And I hope I never have to find out. But that's exactly what Eddie did. He forgave his attacker. And as Eddie said, that gave him control of his life back. And I hadn't even thought of that. The guy that killed Officer George DeSalvia, that shot Eddie multiple times and left him bleeding in the street to die, that person who, in my opinion, has no right to live in the same world as our heroes, he no longer has any influence over Eddie and the way he's moved forward. By his own account, Eddie Diaz is not the same person he was while fighting in Iraq. He's not the same person that worked at the Orlando Police Department to serve and protect his fellow man. The circumstances of February 3rd, 2000 left him a different man, one who had to relearn how to walk, eat, think, live, one who had to give up his beloved profession of being a public servant, and then had to deal with depression, anxiety, not really knowing how or if this would all work out. I can't even begin to imagine what kind of demons were in his head after that shooting. But here's the thing. He never quit. And that's the message here. Eddie Diaz never gave up. He never quit. He adapted. He persevered. He overcame those circumstances that would have defeated so many others. Even though his mindset was completely different from his military and police days, he got it right. He accepted these new challenges, but Eddie never accepted defeat. He accepted these new challenges. But Eddie never accepted defeat. His life became one of resilience, of appreciating that he'd been given a second chance, and it's enabled him to put his family first. When I asked Eddie, I said, what's your current occupation? And without hesitation, he said, I'm a basketball dad. Basketball dad. Now, you just got to love that, right? Eddie, thank you for your unwavering service to our country. Brother, you set the standard for the rest of us to try and meet. Your actions while under enemy fire, both in the military and the police department, have shown us what a hero is and what a hero looks like. And to your unbelievable wife, Nancy, our unsung hero, you became an example of what our relationship should be. You demonstrated and continue to do so just what love and commitment are all about in our marriages. Thank you for setting that standard for others to emulate and for being there for Eddie. To you both, I say God bless, job well done. In the Bible, Matthew 5:9 says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. And John 15:13 reads, greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friend. Man, may God bless all our members of law enforcement, our military, and all of our first responders. So, Eddie, one last thank you for coming on the Game of Crimes podcast and sharing your adventures. It was an honor to have you on the show, brother. So, if you like today's episodes, go to Apple or Spotify and hit those 5 stars. Only takes you a minute and helps support the show. On YouTube, click on that subscribe button, the like button, and the share button. Help me out here. If you want to send me your comments, you can do that on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to our email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. That's where you'll find all our episodes, our book lists, some merchandise, and some other stuff on there. On Facebook and Instagram, go to Game of Crimes Podcast, and on X, type in Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, go to Game of Crimes Fans and join the best private group on the Facebook platform. That group is run by our favorite mafia queen, Miss Sandy Salvato. But watch out. She rules with an iron fist, but she does wear a velvet glove. And if you're looking for even more content, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to seriousness. So come on over and have some fun. Do me a favor, tell your friends about Game of Crimes. Invite them to check out the show. I truly appreciate you helping me spread the word about the best weekly true crime podcast available. Your support's what really keeps me going, and I mean that wholeheartedly. And just remember this, we can have different ideas and different opinions, but that doesn't mean we cannot continue to be friends. Finally, thanks for joining me to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.